You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 59. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today with me is Bitcoin Sign Guy, and we're actually not talking about that necessarily, but he's working on a new project called Urbit. BSG, welcome.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me. I got to correct you, though. Urbit is a very old project.
Oh, okay.
It's actually older than Bitcoin, as a matter of fact. Not that I'm keeping score or anything, but it's actually interesting that that's the conception about it, because it's just been a very quiet project for a very long time. It was a research project starting in 2002, and then finally became real enough to warrant a startup called Talon, which I believe formed in 2013. So in its formal instantiation, it's younger than Bitcoin. But as far as like when the idea was first hatched, it's been a long time coming.
Cool. So, and for anyone who doesn't know the Sign Guy reference, you, were somewhat internet famous for, holding up a sign behind Janet Yellen that said buy Bitcoin at, the amazing timing to where the scroll at the bottom said that she was they were not interested in auditing the Fed.
I mean, there's no other aspect about me that would be worth e-celebrity. So,
oh man, okay. So tell us about Urbit. What is it, and then we'll kind of get into how it can apply to Bitcoin.
Sure. So in the spirit of bottom shelf Bitcoin, I will say most simply, Urbit is just a new operating system. It's a computer basically that runs on top of your current computer, or at least if you have a Mac or run Linux. So basically any Unix-based machine. And it's a computer that has one goal in mind in terms of how it was designed. And that is to make it very easy for a person to operate a personal server. And I don't know if any of your listeners have ever tried to run their own email server or, host their own website, but it's incredibly difficult under the Unix paradigm. And it basically requires that you study to be a system admin. And so as you extrapolate this into what internet services are, you end up with something that looks like the cloud model today, where you have a user account on someone else's server. I have a Twitter account on Twitter's server, a Facebook account on Zuck's server, et cetera, et cetera. I store my documents on Google's server. And it's not so much that I, desire them to be my digital landlord. It's more so just that I don't have the technological capacity, even as a relatively tech capable person. I don't have the capacity myself to operate those servers, to run my own email. I've tried, but I don't. And so, what Urbit does is it's basically a computer that for very concrete technical reasons is easier for the average person to serve their social data, their messages, their photos, their files to other people on the internet from. And so I think we could start there.
Yeah, I was gonna push back a little bit when you said it's not easy to do, but then I thought about it and it's like all it is, it's services. There's a lot of services that have simplified the process, but you're not doing those things yourself.
Right.
You create a Digital Ocean account and you run, you know, you click the one click install and it goes ahead and does Linux and installs WordPress on top of that or whatever, so that they have simplified the process, but then, you know, they have, in varying degrees, access to all of the data that you're putting on there.
Right. It's really platforms all the way down.
Yeah.
And so instead of trying to, start with nothing, what Urbit actually does is prudent, which is it tries to just say, okay, the existing internet, let's just layer over that and put have Urbit basically be its own little virtual bubble that's going to be where your entire digital life in the future resides. And so this is why you basically currently run Urbit, say, on your Mac, or you do, like you say, acquire a Digital Ocean droplet or hosting of some kind and just run your Urbit on a Unix machine.
Yeah, so you could do it like on a virtual server sort of way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I also operate a company called Planet Market, which offers this type of hosting.
Okay.
I should clarify the different hats that I wear. I am working at Talon, which is the company that basically spearheads Urbit OS development. And then, you know, there's an ever enlarging set of sort of businesses in the Urbit economy. And so Planet Market is another one that is created to help people get their Urbit identity for the first time, to acquire an Urbit address, and then also to basically have a simplified means of hosting that computer.
Okay. So why don't we kind of go into that, the identity thing with Urbit?
Sure. So the Urbit identity system is almost a technology wholly distinct from Urbit, the operating system.
Okay.
So essentially the Urbit ID system is a new namespace, one that, you know, wasn't created by DARPA and,
right,
you know, didn't have a, wasn't incepted with the priorities of the state and, you know, its affiliates.
Can you go into that a little bit? Cause some people may not know the background there.
Sure. So the internet began basically with the DOD collaborating with large research institutions throughout the country. This was like ARPANET, and essentially what it eventually evolved into was that, you know, the naming authorities for the internet, you know, the people that get to say who the real Google is or who the real Facebook is, those institutions were, you know, it was as centralized a genesis as could have been possible. And so Urbit says, well, you know, let's have a crack at creating a private namespace. And so there's 2 to the 32, I believe. Yeah, 2 to the 32 addresses, individual, you know, end user addresses on the Urbit network, and that's approximately 4 billion. Each of those can be accessed through multiple devices. So if you take that into account. You know, basically every person or family on Earth could have, you know, their own identity. And then those identities are clients of intermediate routing nodes. And then those are the individual identities are known as planets. The intermediate nodes are known as stars. They're largely there to provide infrastructure, relations. And then lastly, there's the root nodes, which are akin to, I suppose, you know, the DNS okay. root nodes, which are known as galaxies. And there's 256 of those. And so the network is structured as a tree, primarily for the benefit of peer discovery. So if you want to contact someone on the other part of the network, you need to search for an IP address to contact them under. And so you climb up and then down the tree to query that who might be their sponsor if they know what IP address they can be reached at. And so then after you obtain their IP address, it's a purely peer-to-peer communication protocol. So if you want to read more about how that works, you can read the documentation on AIMES, AMES. That's the name of Urbit's network protocol. But the Urbit identity is sort of the common citizen of that network. And because the address space is scarce, it solves one of the key issues with, you know, the current internet address space. One of the key problems with the way address space currently works, which is spam. So it actually is by design that it costs something to acquire an Urbit address. It doesn't need to be a ton of money. We think that planets are probably, you know, have a long run equilibrium value of maybe $10 or so. But it's low, but it's high enough to deter a spammer from acquiring gigantic blocks of these addresses and spamming you forever with them. So one thing your listeners may not know, because the current internet is very, you know, it's gotten very good at this, but it's full of spam. It's essentially a gutter of spam. If you go into your, if you have a Gmail account, I encourage you to open up your spam folder and see just the sheer quantity of trash email that you get every single day. I mean, it's staggering. And the only way that this has been, that the internet is remotely usable is because, you know, we use, you know, highly sophisticated heuristics to filter out the spam. Like that's, you know, machine learning and all that stuff, which inevitably then further contributes to the centralization of the web, because you can only use email clients that have, you know, those really nice spam filters going for them, et cetera, et cetera. So the question is, how do you solve spam in I don't want to use the D word, but, you know, a decentralized mm-hmm. way that doesn't rely on just a strong man to screen it out and send it to the delete folder, or to ban, you know, Twitter bots, that type of stuff. And one part is, you know, make the names that you network under costly. And then second, make them essentially permanent, such that you can create, you know, useful reputation systems with them. So, you know, blacklists, whitelists, you know, however you want to determine reputation. This is sort of an open question for Urbit, what types of reputation systems will emerge. But the Urbit identity is a very effective and versatile primitive to those reputation systems.
And this was part of, I guess, Adam Back's proposal for, you know, Hashcash was trying to deal with this problem back in the day with email and trying to make a small fee to send an email. So to prevent the spam thing. So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. Making it not terribly costly so that no one ever uses it, but just that doing it in large volumes is, not desirable.
Right. I admire that proposal. I just think people would rather buy a single identity up front than to have to pay internet postage. But I think that both.
I agree. Yeah, I just was making the comparison, right, of like making a small cost.
Of course.
You know, in different, you know, there's different ways to implement that, but making it cost something deters the spam. So.
Right. So yeah, that's basically, before we even get to Urbit OS, yeah, Urbit ID is, you know, I would say a large innovation in and of itself. I know that there's a lot of projects trying to solve distributed identity. But I personally think that this one is good, particularly because of its connection with an entire computer that is capable of, you know, operating your digital life. And so that's I think why Urbit probably has the best shot between the different decentralized identity systems out there.
You mentioned that it was that the identity system was more or less permanent. Does that mean then that where you host the computer, now I know we're kind of transitioning here from the identity system to the computer. Does that mean that the computer needs to be hosted in the same place, or can it be moved?
No. So the computer can be run anywhere. It's just that you need, the identities are custodied currently on, you know, the Ethereum PKI. So it's basically governed by public key infrastructure who can, you know, send a message under a given network address. Because you would need the networking keys for it.
To be able to like move it to a different
place. Right. To be able to move it around or just to, you know, to have it booted, you need the private key essentially.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's move back then to the computer side of things, and you mentioned the Ethereum, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but you know, my understanding is limited about it, but it's kind of like returning computing to being personal. You know, I like the minimalist interface, the not flashy, endorphin, you know, dopamine hit kind of style.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. That's been, I think, a great aspect of Urbit that wasn't, I'm not entirely certain on this, but it wasn't even necessarily in the original vision of Urbit, but it almost made sense. Like, oh yeah, we're making this new internet platform that's entirely user controlled. You know, why would we want it to look like, you know, the casino jails of the cloud that basically do whatever they can to trap their users into, you know, a cycle of platform addiction, really. I mean, if you read some of the literature about how notifications work, you know, you realize that companies like Twitter, Facebook, etc., YouTube, they're simply trying to maximize the amount of time you spend on their sites. And I think there's a, you know, some ethical critiques that can be very effectively and perhaps easily made of those practices.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I actually just made the switch to Graphene OS for my phone, and that's probably bad OPSEC for me to just say it, but whatever. And the kind of, you can view it as a downside or a good side, and I'm trying to figure out where I'm at with it. The notifications for a lot of apps don't work if you don't use the Google services. And so while it can be a little bit frustrating, it's a process that I'm trying to get used to, because it's actually really freeing when I'm out with my family or doing something and I don't have my phone going off all the time. So yeah, the minimizing the notifications is kind of a freeing thing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they don't call it the attention economy for nothing, right?
Yeah.
When the product is free, you are the product.
Right. Exactly. Like exactly. It's hard to make people understand that.
I forget who said that aphorism originally, but it's quite apropos to Urbit's vision.
So what, let's go into what can you do? Maybe what can you do currently, and what's kind of on the, roadmap or the plan for what's possible with Urbit? And I understand that it's, you know, when you're making something new, you can't always know what it will be used for, but what you guys foresee at least.
Right. And just briefly, that is, I think, one of the key distinguishing factors about Urbit is that it is designed to be fully extensible by users in many ways. We don't know what people will want to build once they have, you know, an uninterrupted canvas to, you know, make whatever types of web-enabled systems they want. Currently, we're starting with very basic things, primitive things like messaging, publishing, links sharing, sort of like a Hacker News style, links sharing stuff, collections. And then in the near term, we'll add microblogging. So Urbit will have sort of a Twitter clone, if you will. And then, beyond this, my specific project at Urbit has been related to, you know, the introduction of Bitcoin as the native currency of Urbit. So getting a Bitcoin wallet on Urbit, which is debuting at the end of this quarter, after it gets tested by some of my trusty maximalist friends. shout out to Justin Moon, Yuri. I'm sorry, I didn't ask your permission to mention your names, but I figure you guys are cool with it. Those guys and some others are also going to help, you know, kick the tires, make sure we're doing things by the book. So once we get that Urbit Bitcoin wallet built, you know, it'll be easy to basically pay someone directly to their planet name or their name in your contacts. And this is something we're super excited about because it makes sovereign usage of Bitcoin that much easier. It improves, I think, the UX of sovereign Bitcoin usage. I should mention that the wallet runs an SPV node in the browser. So you have, you know, I guess a heightened degree of sovereignty there versus a pure custodial wallet. And then we also finished a Bitcoin full node library for making, you know, RPC API calls. And so with this, you know, you'll be able to do fully sovereign, you know, Bitcoin transactions directly from your Urbit. And then the from there, basically with those two primitives, you know, we'd like to basically build out commerce and finance on Urbit, you know, using Bitcoin. So a Bitcoin storefront that you can host on your Urbit and, you know, charge people with Bitcoin. Or my original interest was making a peer-to-peer Bitcoin exchange, very much in the style of Bisc or HODL-HODL, where basically you can use your Urbit identity as, you know, a point to accrue, you know, marketplace reputation. And so that's been, I think, a large barrier to P2P Bitcoin markets taking off is, you know, well, how do you solve reputation in a decentralized manner? And so I think that there will be strong potential there for developing an exchange that can respect privacy, but can also give users strong reputational assurances about their counterparty. And so, you know, that's in the future, but, you know, not so far in the future. Building apps on Urbit is, you know, the Urbit OS is written in a functional programming language called Hoon. It's very powerful. So, you know, one man can basically do the work of 10. With regard to, you know, developing new applications.
I guess my question is, like, what makes this better or different than just running your own, say, Ubuntu VirtualBox or virtual, you know, some kind of virtual machine, even if it's not like on somebody else's cloud, you know, on your home computer? What makes this better than just spinning up a virtual server?
Well, that those servers, I suppose, within the Linux paradigm just are not that user friendly to like new developers. Whereas, you know, Urbit's Hoon is like pretty easy. Once you get going with it to, you know, make, you know, capable software. I would just say that, yeah, the things you mentioned are really for people that are, you know, already capable system administrators.
Are there resources already that exist for someone to go out and like learn to program with Hoon?
Yeah, actually there's, there has been a program called Hoon School, which Talon has been running, but now it's transferring to a new organization, called Hooniversity, and they're almost done with their website. It will be out soon, but regardless, you can also just read the, there's lessons on how to, you know, use Hoon in the urbit.org documentation section. And it's incredibly thorough. I am not really a technical person, but I've been able to, you know, learn how to do basic things, with it. So I would encourage anyone who's interested in making, you know, a decentralized app for Urbit to go check that out.
You know, right now you've got messaging links. You know, I see this as, now, would you say that the messaging is end-to-end encrypted? Yeah, I guess it's because it's peer-to-peer, right?
It is, yes. Though I should caveat that by saying that Urbit, one of the projects this year is to pass a security audit. So, you know, we say it's end-to-end encrypted, but I wouldn't take that to the bank until we pass the security audit. But, you know, we believe that, you know, it is, it works as advertised. It's just, you know, I can't make that specific claim yet.
Sure. So this might be good for, you know, we recently saw the acquisition of Keybase by Zoom, and, you know, best case scenario, that means that Zoom gets its encryption issues fixed. But I think there's legitimate concern by a number of groups that use Keybase that it's kind of the spells doom for the end-to-end encrypted messaging side of Keybase.
Yeah,
so this might be a potential haven for that.
Of course. Yeah, I would certainly invite any Keybase groups that are looking for end-to-end encrypted chat. I mean, obviously I can't make the claim that Urbit is what Keybase was currently, but it's certainly our intention to become that, you know, by the end of the year. But moreover, I think the point that can be made is that, you know, Keybase was bought by Zoom. Like, it would be impossible for Zoom to basically, you know, buy Urbit. And, yeah. And we can talk about that basically. Like, there's 80 people that own the 256 Urbit galaxies. There may actually be more, but like, we know of 80. And so to control the Urbit address space, you know, you'd have to acquire at least 129 of those galaxies. And so this type of collusion could basically never happen. Not only that, but it's incredibly expensive for a company to try to even acquire all of the Urbit galaxies. And so they're also owned by extremely stubborn cypherpunks.
So that's good to know. So
basically, yeah, this sort of gives you an idea like that Urbit has this great, you know, inertia of people that believe in its mission. And it is unlike Keybase, you know, I mean, not to keep memeing the D word, but, you know, decentralized to the point where it's incredibly difficult to co-opt.
Now, let me back up on what you said there for a second. So the galaxies, that's the root node?
Yeah, those are the root nodes.
Okay. So how much control, someone who has a galaxy, how much control do they have of the stars and planets downstream of that?
So, you know, they can decide to not route packets for them. But that's basically as far as it goes. You can, as any client node or client address, rather, you know, addresses that are farther out on the tree, mm-hmm. you can, Urbit prioritizes radical exit as its governance mechanism. So if you think that one of your infrastructure providers is abusing you, it's essentially, you know, one click to escape and find another one. And so we actually think that there will be a robust market for, you know, good infrastructure that essentially incentivizes people to, you know, get, you know, deals on, you know, routing, storage, content delivery, whatever, what have you, and minimizes, you know, abuse, like, you know, privacy intrusion, that sort of thing.
So you would just, you could go off and join another star or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, if you were, so one situation that we've seen already is you have you know, the NFT exchange OpenSea. It's one old place that sells Urbit address space, but a lot of the planets that they sell are under inactive stars, and so those inactive stars basically are not reachable to give that planet, you know, their first sync to the network.
Okay.
And so what they've had to do is, you know, release themselves from that relationship and find another.
Gotcha.
But it's, you know, by design, it's like very easy to do.
All right, now let's kind of go back. You mentioned earlier, and I think that a lot of people you talked about having Bitcoin maximalists in there, but I know from looking at it myself and then talking to you that there is tie in somehow with the Ethereum ecosystem. So what is that about, and what is, because I think that's probably going to be the strongest objection. And I know, like we've mentioned Keybase a number of times, and that was a lot of people's objection with Keybase, was that they got involved in Stellar. And I know that, like, at some point, when you are a centralized entity, developers got to eat too, right? And so I think that was kind of the issue with Keybase, why they got involved with Stellar, and then why they were acquired by Zoom, is because it was not a profitable, open source is not always profitable.
Right. Exactly. Sure. I would say on the Ethereum question, there's a couple points that I can make initially that have, already been made by people at Urbit, which is primarily Urbit is not taking the side of Ethereum. We are currently using Ethereum, if you will. And, the analogy was made every band that ever, signs to a label says, the label's not, using us, we're using the label for distribution. But in the case of Urbit, it is legitimately true. I think that Urbit has one of the least involved integrations with the Ethereum PKI. It simply was they originally looked at Bitcoin, right? Because they wanted namespace to be secured by, the tools of the 21st century, i.e. a blockchain. Because if you want to have, cryptographic ownership of something, it makes sense that way. So they looked at Bitcoin, but as we both know, the computational offerings of Bitcoin are relatively limited currently. And so they chose Ethereum basically out of, practical necessity, not out of some, moral or aesthetic, attraction or endorsement. And so this also means that in the future, the Urbit PKI can be, migrated off of Ethereum. If Bitcoin developed a capability to be able to host the Ethereum PKI, I'm sure probably a majority of Urbit users would prefer that, because it is, the strongest chain. We're on Ethereum for the time being, but yeah, by no means permanent. And also the choice to use Ethereum was also an alternative to rolling our own blockchain, which, was entirely, pointless in our estimation. It's we're out to make a deterministic operating system, that's a big of a challenge enough. It's do we also have to solve the Byzantine generals problem? Please, I hope not.
Yeah. So, I guess that was going to be my question, is then if at some point, and I think probably I would get crap for saying this, but I think Ethereum's going to be around for a while. Whether I agree with it or whether I think it makes economic sense or whatever, I think it's probably going to be a while before Ethereum totally collapses. But if it were to collapse, what does that mean for Urbit?
Sure. They addressed this when they chose this, and they called Urbit, the Urbit creators called Ethereum, flaming, what was it? A flaming trash or something like that. And they very much were aware that it has discretionary human governance and could utterly collapse politically, especially given, the centralization of, the cult of Vitalik, etc. And so as political conflict grows on Ethereum, if it grows, you know, the decision to migrate Urbit elsewhere would certainly be, you know, revived. So whether that's, and also not to mention like the root nodes, the galaxies as a federation, they could self-host the Urbit PKI. You know, you'd have to trust that they're as, you know, the Urbit network would only be as decentralized as those galaxies, but that's, you know, another alternative that always exists.
Could you do something like, I know there's talk, and I'm not really savvy in being able to explain the technical side of it, but where you anchor various states back to the Bitcoin blockchain or something along those lines?
I had thought of that, and I've basically been pursuing this as a research question, sort of on and off with Bitcoiners I know of. I'm probably not going to be the Bitcoin genius to engineer something like that, but I do know that there's Bitcoiners who are motivated to pursue those research questions, like the you know, Liquid or Elements sidechains that Blockstream runs. Like, I've looked at those. I'm just probably not the right person to make that evaluation. But I very much am in support of those who are.
Yeah. Well, maybe somebody will hear this and come help out with that.
Yeah. Please. If that is something that interests you, you know, please get in touch with me.
There was something I was going to ask earlier when we were talking about the Bitcoin wallet. Oh, I know. You mentioned using the identities. Would that be something along the lines of like a, oh gosh, what BIP is it? It's the one that's like for pay NIMs.
Is that,
I don't want to say that one. Hang on, let me look it up.
Sure.
Yeah, it's 47. That's what I thought it was, but I didn't want to, you know, make an idiot of myself and say whichever one, the one that BitPay's terrible codes were.
Right.
So, yeah, 47. The reusable payment codes. Would it be something along those lines, or its own thing, or
sort of? So the way it works is, you know, you would pass someone's Urbit address into, you know, the field of the payee, and when you do that, it would ping their ship. We call computers an instance of an Urbit computer a ship. It would ping their Urbit for a receive address, and so this makes it so that it's private. You're getting the address in a peer-to-peer fashion as well.
So then their ship would send your ship back an address.
Mm-hmm. And then you can pay that address directly. The wallet will also have a feature where, so the Urbit addresses are cryptographic assets, right? So you have a seed that's associated with your Urbit address. And so you can actually derive, you know, a Bitcoin XPub from that seed. So you can basically, Urbit can come with a baked in Bitcoin wallet. So that's option one. But then option two is we're using the Bcoin wallet backend. So you can also, you know, use a hardware wallet.
Okay.
If you don't want to keep your coins on Urbit, which is right. We're still in the sort of reckless hashtag reckless type phase until we pass the security audit. And even then, you know, I don't think that, you know, people would use their Urbit for more than, you know, to be their Bitcoin checking account for at least some time. Maybe it would be their vault, like in the future, if we could, you know, integrate stuff like multi-sig security. We'll have to see how, I guess, institutional take up of Urbit is. We are currently expanding the, you know, different Urbit APIs right now, with a program called Airlock, which is basically designed to let other companies use Urbit essentially as a service. But you know, that's still a ways off. So what I see, you know, Urbit being good for in the near future is, you know, being a sort of Venmo, like a Cash App for, you know, Bitcoin directly, or, you know, being a place to host or purchase things from an online store in Bitcoin, sort of a hub for all of that. And then the peer-to-peer exchange thing for acquiring Bitcoin, obviously.
Yeah. What are the coolest things that you've seen non-Bitcoin related
for Urbit? Things? Yeah. So, I mean, I'm very excited about the microblogging, the Urbit Twitter. If any of the listeners have an idea for a name of what Urbit Twitter should be called, I'm all ears. I think nothing, almost anything is better than herb. that's something I'm really looking forward to. It's also interesting that we're building this at a time when Jack is looking, you know, engaging in initiatives to, you know, decentralize Twitter, which, you know, I don't think could ever come from Twitter. It's like you can never convince someone to coup themselves.
Right.
There's no, the notion of we'll decentralize later is an utter farce. So I think that basically seeing an Urbit version of all those centralized platforms that we currently use is what interests me the most. And then not only that, but you know, an early notion of Urbit was that we could also be an API aggregator for those cloud services while people are still, you know, using them. So that'll be interesting to see if those projects could exist. You know, we'll know Urbit has won when, you know, Facebook Messenger, you know, when Facebook makes their like Facebook Messenger app for Urbit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
it's sort of like a bi-directional, like the sort of bi-directional integrations are probably going to be, I don't know, it's interesting indicators of, you know, the traction.
When you say the API aggregator, what does that look like?
So I mean, we have our iPhones, right? And, you know, it's one system, but, you know, we still have an app for every single you know, service that we use, and they all have their own streams of notifications. They all have their own interfaces. It's like, what if you could designate the type of interface that you wanted to receive all of your content through?
Oh, okay.
And so that's one thing that relates to when I say Urbit is extensible. You know, Urbit does not need to have, you know, there's no one look of Urbit, or at least there won't be. Right now, you know, we have Tlon puts out OS1. Which is, you know, the first real user facing like implementation of Urbit. But you know, there's tons of crazy ways that you could order an Urbit system from an interface standpoint. I mean, you could have a more, you know, colorful, visually Baroque design pattern. You could stick with, you know, the minimalist, very sort of almost austere, but sort of the comm computing thing that we have, that we've created at Talon. Undoubtedly, you know, companies will come in and try to turn Urbit into the casino jail for whatever their implementation is. But, you know, I certainly don't think that that would be incredibly popular. I even spoke to one guy that wanted to create basically a voxel interface for Urbit. Like voxels are those, you know, those 3D cubes you see like Minecraft. Like imagine walking around a map and hitting a block, you know, to send a file or some stuff like that. Like it can, like the only limit is really the imagination of the user with Urbit, I think, which is what makes it so exciting.
Why do you think, I guess this is kind of a twofold thing when looking at, I mean, this is some time off from now, but let's, you know, being optimistic that Urbit takes off. And when you talk about kind of that transition to a large number of people making use of it or companies coming in, what you said, you don't see that being very popular. The going back to the, you know, casino jail style, very flashy, very, you know, enticing, kind of advertise heavy, bright colors. I mean, those kind of things are making use of, to some extent, systems that are just like biologically in us, right? So mm-hmm. What makes you hopeful that that's not going to take off or take over on Urbit?
Right. Well, I think it's somewhat inherent in who Urbit's, who the founding cohort of Urbit users are. I mean, we're basically the privacy maximalist minority rule that's basically imposing Urbit on the world. You know, you're familiar with like Taleb's minority rule. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, why is all the lemonade in the grocery store kosher if, you know, there's only 1% of people in the country who keep kosher, that type of thing. The users of Urbit essentially are intolerant to, you know, give up their privacy.
Yeah.
It will be all applications of that sort that are established first on Urbit. And so I think that that's really the spirit of the project.
So by the time somebody who wants all of your attention gets,
yeah, by there, the time, you know, the cloud, you know, megacorp realize, you know, it's basically too late for them. You know, there's an open social protocol for every type of media, et cetera, et cetera.
So then, you know, my other question when you were talking about Twitter is, you know, Mastodon exists and there are people who use it, but I don't think a lot of people use it compared to the amount of people that use Twitter. And there's kind of that first mover advantage. So, I mean, is this something that, and I don't know, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. Is this something where you don't want, like, you want to be selective in who you, in the same way that maybe we should have been with Bitcoin in the beginning, you know, be selective with who you shill it to and who you try and convince to migrate, or do you just tell everyone about it? Or
I mean,
what's your thoughts on that?
I think that there are, you know, key affinities, people that have, you know, pre-existing affinities with Urbit, like Bitcoiners, for example, you know, people that value digital sovereignty in an incredibly sincere way. I think that Mastodon users also, you know, take that seriously. You know, I wrote a blog post about this a while back. But the realization is really that, you know, there's, you know, the virtual realm is basically subsuming, you know, the realm of the real. And so more and more of our lives, our sovereignty, our, you know, ability to just do things is bound by the cybernetics of digital systems. And, you know, this is easily proven. Like, would you rather get pickpocketed or SIM swapped? Like, one is clearly much more devastating or potentially so. And so, you know, we essentially need to sharpen our tools that give us, you know, autonomy in the digital space. And it's basically up to, you know, up to us to build this through stuff like, you know, Bitcoin and Urbit. I mean, the realization is really that a server, you know, a digital store of information is, you know, an instrument of sovereignty. It's an instrument. It's a way of wielding power virtually. And, you know, Urbit is a server, just like Bitcoin is a server, that seeks that same end of like own your keys, own your data.
Yeah, and I see it as something that is a tool to be used, rather than a lot of these things are kind of trying to, they won't come out and say this, but a lot of them are trying to control you in various ways.
Absolutely. The notion of, you know, cybernetic capture is certainly not lost on me and many of my partners at Talon and other people throughout the Urbit ecosystem. So I mean, it is with a certain deadly sincerity that we, you know, are trying to, you know, bring this project to term.
So what is, you know, if you had to cast a vision of the future that you wanted, like, where is that line between making use of technology so that we're not, you know, Luddites living in the woods? I mean, I love the woods and I love nature. I'm just saying, I think there is a place for technology and I think we can't totally ignore it. But where's that line between we use technology, we make use of it to, you know, as tools to further our goals, but without letting it control us.
Right. I think that by being our own, you know, Urbit gives the ordinary user the opportunity to be their own cybernetic master, essentially. Like, you control the flows that reach you. Everything on your computer is run by you. If you want to stop sharing, you know, a stream of data that you generate, you know, it's the valve is there at your disposal. So in many ways, Urbit really is a way to return computers to just the dumb computational machines that they were originally meant to be. You know, they originally called, the first usage of the word computer actually referred to a person that crunched large numbers for, you know, scientists and mathematicians. They were called, like, I think I saw a photo recently, like Albert Einstein and his computer. And it was a man who, you know, who literally iterated the equations that Einstein was working on. And so you know, we've ever since, you know, the ever since we sort of started using, you know, digital computers and imbuing them with, you know, the soul of artificial intelligence and all of that, you know, they've been perniciously perniciously incorporating themselves into their into our lives to an increasingly you know, disproportionate extent. And so I think that by dumbing it down, we can actually stem that. We can actually stem that trend.
So Urbit helps us avoid the Matrix.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're a transhumanist accelerationist, I'm sure you can figure out a way to, you know, use Urbit to, you know, dive ever deeper still. And now you're like, you know, you can hash your romantic consent on the blockchain and, you know, shit like that. But I think for the average user, it's just, you know, returning the computer to its rightful place as a simple tool in our lives that we use to engage in commerce, keep in touch with people, you know, through just basic correspondence, you know, maybe make a spreadsheet, maybe advertise our thing. But it doesn't need to be, you know, this combine that, you know, consumes our soul.
Awesome. You know, if somebody wants to try Urbit out, they need to go purchase an Urbit ID, and then what kind of hardware requirements are there to spin up a ship? Is a ship,
right? Yeah, ship. Yeah, ship is sort of the neutral term between whether you're a galaxy, a star, or a planet, or a comet. You know, they're all basically ships.
Hang on real quick before this. You mentioned earlier a name for the, you know, microblogging thing. And I was thinking, like, does it have to be like a astrological theme to the naming system, or you guys have different nomenclature for everything?
Yeah, I know. So a lot of people accuse Urbit of, you know, being an art project because of its adherence to, you know, colorful vocabulary. It does not need to adhere to you know, any preordained pattern, though there are many patterns within, you know, the Urbit universe.
I totally put us on a tangent. You were talking about, like, what the hardware requirements are.
The hardware requirements currently are, you need to map, I think, 2 gigabytes of memory. We've gotten them running on Raspberry Pis. But, you know, my first install was just on a MacBook, and now I have my Urbit running on a VPS in the cloud, and that lets me access it anywhere, anytime. And, you know, I have relatively good, you know, privacy assurances about that VPS. And so that's probably how I think most normies will interface with Urbit in the future, as opposed to running it. Though I think that really depends on, you know, the evolution of the server at home in a box product. You know, I know that Casa has sort of struggled with this. I know that there's other companies in the Bitcoin space, like Nodal, or I think Samurai has a node in a box. Like, if these take off, you know, certainly Urbit could dwell there for the ultra sovereign, you know, power user of Urbit. Maybe more likely that the majority of us will, you know, find an Urbit hosting provider, like Planet Market or Tlon in the future will do hosting, and I'm sure many others. So you know, it's sort of, you can pick up Urbit at your own speed, sort of like how, you know, you can run a Bitcoin node if you're a Bitcoin power user, or you can, you know, just use a, you know, custodial wallet if you're not.
You're going to get crucified for saying stuff like that.
I mean, hey, man, do you know where your keys are? I have my full node. So I personally advocate it. I'm just saying it's, you know.
No, I know. I'm giving you a hard time.
The option is left up to the user. It's at least, you know, flexible.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm just giving you grief.
No, I mean, and hey, look, the grief is the whole point. Where Bitcoin is a social movement. So it's like if we don't commit ourselves to affecting these you know, cultural sea changes, you know, why even bother?
Yeah. So when you purchase an ID, does that someone may have told me, does that have to be done with Ethereum, or how can people purchase the IDs?
There are some places that sell them for Ethereum. I think Urbit Live sells for Ethereum. Planet Market sells for Ethereum, Bitcoin, and USD. I think Urbit Live might also be adding USD, but I'm unsure. I think DigitalOcean requires Ethereum, but, you know, in the future, I think that the norm will be just USD. Okay. Though, you know, because, you know, I love you and I value your users not having to, you know, pay to test Urbit out. Like, I'll get you a stack of Urbit planets and you can distribute those to your users. So we're still sort of it. We're still in the faucet days of Urbit, if you will.
The faucet days, man. Yeah.
So, like, you know, especially if, like, you know, you're still mounting the wall of skepticism about Urbit, like, just try it out. I'll get you some that you can distribute.
Okay. So,
yeah,
we'll figure out a way to distribute those for those listening. It will not probably not just be like, you know, free reign to first come first serve. There'll probably be a vetting process of what you're hoping to do with it. But yeah, I mean, skeptics welcome. I just, you know,
of course. Yeah. I mean, they're probably, we're still like trying to basically make the system, the sort of Urbit address acquisition flow a little smoother. So yeah, we'll get those to you soon. You could probably just like hand them out on Twitter or something like that.
Cool. Okay. How can people keep up with development of Urbit and what you're doing with the Bitcoin side of it and all of that?
Sure. So my Twitter is at BitcoinUR. Like you are like Bitcoiner. It's like my crappy pun. The name on that account is Urbitcoin. So if you hit me up there, my DMs are open. I can get you, you know, squared away with a planet and, also, you know, add you to my Urbitcoiner, group on Urbit, which is our little discussion, and dev group for building out the wallet, the node integration, like all that stuff is sort of flowing through there these days. I encourage you to reach out. Otherwise it's just urbit.org. That's really got a ton of you know, useful resources. And then one thing I might highlight on urbit.org is there's a section called community grants. So if you listen to this interview and are, you know, sold on Urbit and you have a group that, you know, has been displaced from, you know, whatever platform you were previously coordinating on, and you want to try Urbit wholesale, we have a community grants program to get everyone in your group like a free Urbit address. So I would encourage you guys to check out that if you have, you know, a bunch of friends that all want to try out Urbit together.
Very cool. So Twitter's the best way to get a hold of you for that?
Yeah, that's actually just urbit.org, I think, /community/community grants or something like that. But it's on the urbit.org website. You don't need to, you know, process that one through me.
Okay, cool. And we'll have links in the show notes for that kind of stuff. All right, man. Well, we're at like 1:15 total time here. So I want to make sure I'm not taking up too much of your time, but,
no, not at all, anything man. Else? Thank you so much for having me on. And, yeah, anyone, if you do get on Urbit, you know, hit me up. My planet name is Pindet Timmut, PindetTimmut. And so, yeah, shoot me a DM on Urbit and I'll add you to the Urbit Coiners group. So hope to see you all online.
Yeah. Awesome. And I'll put that in the show notes as well, that link. And, at some point when I get my stuff set up, I'll put that in the show notes as well and blast it out and everything like that. So I look forward to trying this out and hopefully we can get some, people that are interested in, learning this stuff and expanding it for the good of mankind and Bitcoin as well. So,
I mean, yeah.
I know I'm being a little outlandish there, but it doesn't necessarily have to be.
There you go. Yeah. Urbit is just, you know, make the computer dumb again.
Yeah. Can we get some MAGA style hats that say that?
Yeah. Make computing stupid again. Exactly. Anyway, thanks so much for having me, man. And I hope to see you, you know, back on the Bitcoin conference circuit once this quarantine biz is all over.
Right. Yeah, that will be good. It'll be good to see people in real life again.
Very good. All right, well, take care, and I'll catch you soon.
All right, likewise. All right, guys, that's the episode for today. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Bitcoin Sign Guy. You guys check out Urbit and follow him on Twitter at BitcoinUr, BitcoinUr. I'll have links in the show notes for all of that. And then follow me, obviously, on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC. Send me a DM if you are interested in getting in on that development side with Urbit. I'm not exactly sure what that process is going to look like I said, of distributing those identities, but if that's something that you are interested in, like I said, DM me and kind of give me an explanation of what you think it could be used for, what you're wanting to either try out or look around at, and we will find a way to try and make the most of those identities. I'm not looking to hoard a whole bunch of them. I just don't want to give them out to, you know, 5 people who aren't going to do anything with it either. I want it to be a beneficial thing for Urbit as well. So, like I said, you can follow me on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC. If you want to support the show, remember the best way to do that is subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. Share this episode out with your friends. And then, you know, another good thing is always to leave a review on iTunes or someplace like that so that helps boost the ratings. It helps more people see the show. And stuff like that. If you want to support beyond that financially, you can go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/donate. And there are ways there that you can support me. And also, if you are interested in free market ideas and liberty, there's this great book series called The Tuttle Twins. If you go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/kidsbook, they are geared towards children, but they're also really great introductory books at an easy to understand level of, like I said, free markets and liberty and these kind of ideas, just put in a very simplified way. Doesn't change the price of the books. I just get a little kickback for the show for you using my referral link. So I have those books for myself and my kids and we love them. So I would never, you know, put something out there that I didn't use myself. And that's going to do it for this week. From Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.